1-574, State of Minnesota versus Trinidad Jesus Garcia. As counsel know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Bond representing the appellant, Trinidad Garcia. Mr. Garcia's case must be reversed and remanded for a new trial based on two Spriegel-related errors. First, the Spriegel victim's first time in court identification of Mr. Garcia violated due process because it was unnecessarily suggestive and unreliable. And without that identification evidence, there was not clear and convincing evidence of the Spriegel incident. Second, the district court erroneously denied Mr. Garcia's request to modify the Spriegel cautionary instruction to clarify for the jury that he had not been convicted of the Spriegel incident. Alternatively, Mr. Garcia's sentence must be reversed and the case remanded because the state's evidence failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was a danger to public safety. I'd like to start with the first issue, and there are a number of legal steps to that issue, admittedly, but I think that the court's task has been simplified somewhat based on the briefs. For example, the state does not argue that if the Spriegel evidence was erroneously admitted, that it was harmless. So that is a step of the analysis that I think is easily satisfied. I also think there is at least an implicit acceptance that if the due process clause applies, that the first step in that admissibility test is pretty easily met, which is to say that if the due process clause applies, the identification procedure that was used was unnecessarily suggestive. The crux of the issue, I think, before the court are the other three steps, and I'd like to start with that due process issue. And the question there is the due process clause triggered when the prosecution, but not the law enforcement, arranges the first time in court suggestive identification? And the answer to that question is most certainly yes. The due process clause applies against the state. It protects a defendant against the admissibility of unreliable and impermissibly suggestive identification evidence. Now, most of the time that identification evidence is obtained by law enforcement because most of our eyewitness identifications happen before trial. It happens in the investigation stage. But there is no principled reason to say that the due process clause applies against law enforcement, but not against the prosecution. The same concerns are at play whether that suggestive identification happens by law enforcement out on the streets or by the prosecution in a courtroom. And that actually has some pretty decent support in the case law as well. If the court looks closely at the language of Perry, the United States Supreme Court case, and Mosley, our Minnesota Supreme Court case, it's very clear to me, at least, that law enforcement is just a shorthand for state action. What matters is whether the identification was spontaneous or whether it was arranged by a state actor. It doesn't matter whether that state actor was a police officer or was a prosecutor. And the cases use language like state action. Mosley says because the state did not arrange the witness's identification, the admission did not violate due process.
Ms. Bond, the other thing I would note with the Mosley case is that the identification there was spontaneous. So why isn't that case similar to this one in that sense as well?
Well, the identification in this case, Judge Reyes, was not spontaneous. It was elicited. The prosecutor subpoenaed this witness, asked the witness on the stand whether she wanted to identify anyone in the courtroom who was the driver of the Buick. And the witness, in response to that question, identified my client, describing him as wearing orange. What happened in Mosley is that the witness was not asked that question on the stand, and rather it was in a break in the trial that the witness, on the witness's own, approached the county attorney and said, I think I recognize the person. So Mosley is very different in that way. Mosley was resolved not because it happened in court or it happened prosecutor versus law enforcement. It was resolved because the identification was spontaneous, and here it was not.
Thank you. Just following up then, you would agree, though, that the case law requires, assuming we agree with you, that there isn't really a distinction between law enforcement and a prosecutor, that it's the state action that matters, that the case law requires that the identification be unnecessarily suggestive, not that it just be suggestive, right?
Correct.
So in this case, where the identification occurred in court, how is that unnecessarily suggestive? Can you address that point?
Sure.
What makes it unnecessarily suggestive as opposed to just suggestive?
Yes. And I understand that is an important distinction. I think case law pretty uniformly recognizes that in-court identification is suggestive along the same lines that a one-man show-up is suggestive. What gets this over the hurdle to an unnecessarily suggestive identification really is the fact, a couple of things. Number one, that the investigator testified she had told this Spriegel witness that they had identified a suspect and they were sort of just trying to tie together the ends. But most significantly is the fact that Mr. Garcia was wearing an orange jumpsuit, and he was the only person in the courtroom who was wearing an orange jumpsuit. So one of the reasons that, for instance, an identification during trial in front of a jury, right, a witness, a victim will be asked routinely to identify the defendant. One of the reasons why that is permissible is, well, number one, there has almost always been an out-of-court identification that has happened already. But number two, the defendant is not wearing jail clothes. And the case law, I think both some of the federal case law I cited and then Minnesota's our own case law talk about the incredibly suggestive and prejudicial effect for a witness of seeing someone wearing jail clothes. I don't know of any case that has said or would say, frankly, that under these circumstances where the witness knows that someone is a suspect, is subpoenaed to come to court to talk about the incident, is asked then to look out into the courtroom and see if they see the suspect, and there's only one person sitting next to defense counsel at counsel table wearing an orange jumpsuit, that I think in my mind, I don't actually think that's a heavy lift to say that that becomes an unnecessarily suggestive identification procedure.
Don't we have evidence in this case that NB said, perhaps later, I'm unclear, that she said in a declarative way that when she saw him in the courtroom, she knew exactly, she recognized him immediately from the prior incident. In other words, a rather clear and emphatic statement doesn't that support the district court's determination that it's not unnecessarily suggestive?
Well, I would disagree. I think where that fact fits in the legal analysis is on the second factor, which is on, we've got the procedure itself.
Excuse me. That's what I meant to ask. Okay. I apologize. Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
So moving to that second prong then of the Ostrom test, which is let's assume there's an unnecessarily suggestive identification procedure. The due process clause then requires that if it's going to be admissible, that identification is otherwise reliable, analyzing those five factors. It's worth noting in the district court's order, I think that the district court doesn't very clearly walk through those five factors. I think that the court tends to skip, it's the page I was looking at was my addendum page 39 of the court's order, kind of jumps right to the clear and convincing standard. Looking at those five factors, and this, I think, Judge Johnson, is where your question comes into play, is one of them is certainty. And now the victim saying I immediately recognized him is not exactly I was 100% certain. So one of my arguments is that one factor of certainty of the identification was not addressed at all. There's no evidence she was not asked, and there's no evidence of how certain she was in her identification. The immediacy, I think, doesn't have any much particular significance because, again, Of course, she immediately recognized him. He's sitting there in an orange jumpsuit. He's the only possible person that she could identify in the courtroom. So I think the immediately recognized him, A, doesn't really line up with those factors, and B, isn't particularly helpful in this particular case, given the suggestiveness of the procedure. And those other factors, I think the only one of those five factors that really remotely balances in favor of reliability is, I would concede that the description of the suspect that the Spriegel victim gave at the time is generally lines up with the description or the characteristics of Mr. Garcia. Now, that being said, I don't think that factor weighs very heavily because it's a very generic description that can describe basically any male in his 20s of mixed race. So I don't think that's a very helpful factor that can weigh particularly heavily in this case. But the other factors all weigh very heavily against a finding of reliability. This identification happened 5 months later. That is a very long period of time in the case law. And so that weighs against finding reliability or admissibility.
My next question is there's another layer to the district court's analysis, and that is relying on the, I'll call it the physical evidence about the vehicle and the things that were found in the vehicle, the connection between the firearm and the casings and so on. And am I correct that it could be that the in-court identification is immaterial if those, if that evidence is sufficient to find by clear and convincing evidence that he committed the incident?
I agree that that next step in the analysis, assuming that the court agrees that the due process clause applies, that both prongs of the Ostrom test are met and the identification evidence violated due process, then the question is, setting aside that identification evidence, is there nonetheless clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Garcia committed the Spriegel incident? Again, I'm going to point to that page 39 of the addendum of the district court's order. I think the district court doesn't do it right. The district court approaches it as there is corroboration of the identification evidence. The question instead is a little more specific, right? It is based on what we know from the requirements in the case law, which is that clear and convincing evidence must make the defendant's participation in the Spriegel Act highly probable. It must show direct participation of identity. And that most of the time, what gets Spriegel evidence over the clear and convincing hurdle is direct testimony of identification or a confession. And if that identification evidence is not admissible and we don't have a confession, we are left with some circumstantial evidence for sure, but certainly not enough to get to the point where this court can say it is highly probable that he committed the event. The car
Ms. Bond, I acknowledge your point that initially the district court does tie it to corroboration of Envy's testimony, but first of all, it can be based on circumstantial evidence. It doesn't have to be direct evidence. Second of all, there's a lot of information and there's a lot of testimony that had been provided with respect to how they tied appellant to that car, to that incident, the prior video, all of that information. It seems like there's quite a bit of evidence that had been presented even beyond NB's testimony to show by clear and convincing evidence that he in fact was tied to that West St. Paul shooting. So I mean, can you address that a little bit more? Because it does seem like, I don't know if we can just dismiss that right out of hand because there's a lot there.
I certainly don't think the court should dismiss it. I think that the question again is what we have is there is certainly clear and convincing evidence that the car that was registered to Mr. Garcia was the car used in the West St. Paul incident. And I think there's also clear and convincing evidence that the gun that was found on Mr. Garcia 10 days later was the gun that fired, according to the BCA, that fired the casing that was found in the Westfall car. But that has to be viewed, again, those are circumstantial evidence of identity. They don't rise to the level of clear and convincing, given how demanding the clear and convincing standard is. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's not preponderance. And so the gun, for instance, what we know from the DNA evidence from the gun is that both the places that were tested on the gun revealed mixtures of four or five people. There were a lot of people who had contact with the gun. And that's significant. I think that's significant to say we don't have other kinds of linkages that we would need that clearly say we think it's highly probable. We have definite evidence here that not just that the car was involved, not just that the gun involved, but that Mr. Garcia was driving the car on the date of the West St. Paul incident. And that identification testimony was super important, both to the state and to the district court in finding that this pending criminal charge met the hurdle of clear and convincing. And I see that my I'm out of time. I would be happy to address any of the other issues on rebuttal if the court would like. Thank you.
It appears there are no further questions for you at this time, but you will have time for rebuttal, as noted. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Hemming. I'm an assistant Chisago County attorney representing the state of Minnesota, respondent in this case. Your Honors, the respondent would request that this court affirm the conviction of appellant for two primary reasons. One, the in-court identification was not unnecessarily suggestive. And number two, the jury properly found that the appellant is a dangerous offender. So, jumping right to the meat of it in regards to the Spriegel.
Counsel, on that point, on the Spriegel point, do we even need to reach the due process argument? Is the circumstantial evidence sufficient to show that it's highly probable that appellant was driving the car in the Spriegel incident?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would suggest, Your Honor, that there is a plethora of other evidence outside of the identification that supports the clear and convincing standard. Number one, the vehicle that defendant was driving was captured on a MnDOT video two blocks from the scene of the shooting. That same vehicle was impounded into a St. Paul police impound lot. In that same vehicle was identification information for appellants, such as bail receipts and traffic citations. Inside that vehicle, they located a shell casing, and that shell casing matched the gun that was taken off of appellant when he was taken from a separate vehicle during the case in chief, the principal shooting on Interstate 35, the Chisago County case. Those matched. Appellant was stopped by the St. Paul Police Department driving that Buick 2 weeks prior. There was body cam footage from that St. Paul police officer introduced in the Spriegel hearing itself and ultimately at trial. So that evidence in itself, Your Honor, meets the clear and convincing standard. I won't dispute that the identification by the witness in West St. Paul was important. It certainly was. But that was just one aspect of the totality of the evidence presented that met the clear and convincing standard in which the district court cited in the order.
What about appellant's point during oral argument or counsel's point during oral argument that there was the DNA test showed the test of the gun showed DNA of four or five people? Does that affect our analysis?
Your Honor, it doesn't, and I don't have the DNA results in front of me, but the DNA results showed conclusively that appellant could not be excluded. If I recall correctly, it was one of those 99.99% of the people could be excluded except for appellant, and I do agree there was a mixture. And what the BCA will tell you is that's very common on firearms that there's a mixture. So, but that specific point, Your Honor, I don't think is entirely relevant for this consideration because that particular firearm was taken off the appellant.
Okay, thank you. If you can, though, address the argument that you were going to make about whether the identification was unnecessarily suggestive, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. One point I'll make, Your Honor, the initial point I should say, is that the two controlling cases that this court has is the Perry versus New Hampshire and the State v. Mosley, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court decision. Perry is a U.S. Supreme Court decision. Appellant cites many cases in his brief. Some of those are federal district courts. Some of those are other circuits, not Eighth Circuit. And some of those are Supreme Courts from other states. None of those decisions are binding or have any precedential value. They may be persuasive, but they have no precedential value for this court. What Perry says very specifically, Your Honors, is that it has to be law enforcement. And I disagree with the suggestion that law enforcement is the equivalent to state action. None of these cases suggest that. What Perry suggests is that the purpose of a potential suppression of an identification is to deter misconduct on behalf of police. Deter misconduct, for example, of setting up a identification that's faulty or things like that. So state Mr. action Henning, is not, excuse me, law enforcement is not state action or is not equivalent.
But Mr. Hemming, I think you hit on a good point in terms of making sure that that it deters misconduct. Wouldn't qualifying this as not being unnecessarily suggestive action by the state by having an in-court ID when all you have in the room are a bunch of lawyers and suits and judges, a judge in a robe, and then you have one person sitting there in an orange outfit, potentially even in handcuffs or leg cuffs or both, and have, for the very first time, a witness identify the alleged perpetrator. Doesn't that seem, it seems a little illogical to allow that to happen as a first identification. Seems like that would be the same problem that you're trying to prevent as you would law force identification by making it unnecessarily suggestive.
Your Honor, how I would respond to that is, number one, there was two identifications in this case. The case in which was a Spriegel hearing where there was no jury present, he was in the orange jumpsuit. At his actual jury trial with the identification, he was in street clothes. I just wanted to make that clarification.
Wouldn't it be a different situation if he was sitting there in a suit at the Spriegel hearing versus sitting there in a jumpsuit, which clearly identifies that that person is in jail?
Your Honor, I would suggest the difference between what the police would do on the street in terms of their identification and what would occur in a courtroom are two dramatically different circumstances. And it's for this reason. In a courtroom, a defendant is represented by counsel. And in this case, he was represented by counsel at his Spriegel hearing. Second, there is a district court judge who is a neutral in there. What counsel can do for a client is can argue, just as we were talking about today, that it's unnecessarily suggestive that he's in a jumpsuit, can cross-examine that witness. And ultimately, a district court can take into consideration the case law in making a determination of whether the ID is reliable. So that doesn't exist on the street. There's no one looking over the shoulder of the police and saying, hey, that's suggestive, or questioning the police contemporaneous at the time that the identification is made. In both the Spriegel hearing and separately in the trial, appellant was represented by counsel and the witness was cross-examined on the point of the identification. All those separate factors that are highlighted in Ostrom, those five factors, those are the types of questions in which counsel asked the witness if determining the reliability. And again, separately, the judge in that case had the opportunity, aware of the case law, aware of the reliability determinations, and in turn found that the witness identification was credible, knowing at the time that the defendant was in an orange jumpsuit.
Counsel, how does the presence of counsel affect the initial identification where the prosecutor is asking the witness whether she saw the driver in the courtroom?
Your Honor, I think what it does, I apologize, I'm getting the sun in my eyes here. What it does is the attorney for, in this instance, appellant, is able, at the moment that the identification is happening, is able to challenge that identification. Not months down the road in this type of setting or in an actual court hearing, but at the very moment that witness says, that's the guy in the orange jumpsuit. The attorney can say, you know what, you're making that just because the guy's in the jumpsuit and there's no one else in the courtroom. And those are the types of questions that were posed by the counsel representing appellant in this instance at the Spriegel hearing and actually at the jury trial itself.
But Mr. Hemming, isn't the damage done by that point? I mean, I'm just trying to look at it from a kind of common sense perspective. If I'm a witness and I'm walking in and I had a drive-by shooting and I got to look at the person, but according to the record, he had tinted windows. So query how well she actually was able to see him. But I'm walking in, I'm the witness, I'm a victim of drive-by shooting. I go into the courtroom. I other than that incident, I had never seen a defendant before. I walk in, I see judge in robe, I see a couple lawyers in suits, and I see somebody in a yellow jumpsuit or orange jumpsuit. Isn't at that time the process going through my mind, oh, that must be the person that shot at me, because he's the only person that's in the courtroom who's in an orange jumpsuit. Isn't the damage done right by that point? And no matter what other safeguards are in place, it's not going to change the fact that now that is put into my mind, that must be the person right there.
Your Honor, I don't want to dismiss the idea of a jumpsuit outright. I think, you know, I think there is some credence to that aspect. But what I would respond to it is a judge then has to make the determination whether that was a reliable identification, a neutral district court judge. So a district court judge could say, you know what, that identification was not reliable because the only reason it was made because that person was sitting in a jumpsuit. So it's not the end just at that very moment. The court still then has to make inquiry of whether it was a reliable identification with those other factors. So it's not the end of the inquiry at the very moment that the identification is made. So getting back to the beginning in some respect, number one, Your Honors, I would suggest since law enforcement did not initiate this identification, out of the gate, almost immediately, the argument fails. And number two, if we get past that point of whether there's a substantial likelihood of misidentification is what the language is, I would suggest there is not a substantial likelihood of misidentification because, as Perry indicates, the procedures in trial itself are set up to challenge the identification. Cross-examination, for example, making arguments and closing arguments, making opening statements, the rules of evidence, jury instruction on the fallibility of eyewitness identification, the fact that the case needs to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's all these other factors that Perry cites to as a reason why that in itself is not the end of the inquiry. So for those two reasons, Your Honors, the state would, or your appellant would suggest here that that per Perry and ultimately per Mosley, this was not an unlawful or impermissibly suggestive identification. I'll add, I think, Judge Reyes, you had commented in comparison with the Mosley case, well, wasn't it spontaneous? Well, the facts in Mosley are similar, but not completely together. In that case, as you indicated, the witness told an advocate, oh, I think that's the guy, and ultimately did identify him in court. That's not what happened here, but it is in some capacity what happened here because the witness was testifying to other facts of the case other than the identification. And in the course of the testimony of the witness said, yes, I can identify the person who was driving that vehicle. The witness, for example, testified that I had a clear look at him as that vehicle drove by. Oh, excuse me. I thought there was a question. So I see I have a short period of time left, and I can answer any further questions on the identification piece, but I wanted to move along to suggest on the dangerous offender piece of the argument by appellant. And on that point, the dangerous offender statute 609.1095 subdivision 2 has three primary factors to consider. One, did the jury find that he's 18-year-old, appellant was 18 years old at the time. He stipulated to that fact. Number two, did he have two prior convictions for violent crimes? He had a conviction for assault in the third degree in 2017 and assault in the second degree in 2012. Ultimately, the question was, does the fact finder determine whether the offender is a danger to public safety? And what I would suggest today, Your Honors, is the fact from those two prior convictions and the fact that the jury had since found him guilty of this drive-by shooting and had heard and considered the evidence of the West St. Paul shooting, a person does not need a 15 or 20 year criminal history to be a danger to public safety. It's a factual question that a fact finder could make, and the jury hearing the entirety of the trial plus knowing of those prior convictions made the determination that he was in fact a danger to public safety.
I have a quick question for you in that regard. In your brief, maybe I didn't read it correctly, but I'm wondering what you seem to be arguing that we wouldn't review that finding. We wouldn't consider whether the record evidence supports the finding that he is a danger to public safety. What standard of review should we apply to that determination?
Excuse me, Your Honor. I see my time has elapsed. Can I respond?
No, please provide a complete and full answer to Judge Cochran's question.
Thank you. Your Honor, the standard of review would be the same as reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence in the underlying trial as it would in the sentencing phase in a Blakely-type scenario. It would be the evidence presented most favorable to the verdict, that the fact finder disbelieved any evidence that conflicted with the verdict. A defendant bears a heavy burden to overturn a jury verdict. We will not disturb a jury's verdict if the jury, acting with due regard for the requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, could reasonably find the existing of the aggravating fact. That's the standard of review. And I guess in response about the comments of the brief, I simply meant to say that the types of arguments that were put forth by appellant were probably more appropriate standing in front of the jury rather than on appeal. I do believe that the sufficiency of the evidence standard does apply for Your Honors in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hemming. Ms. Bond, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of quick points on the identification issue, and then I'd like to address the sentencing issue as well. As far as those other safeguards, I'll call them, the fact that there's counsel, the fact that there's a judge, the fact that there's jury instructions, the fact that there's cross-examination, those are only relevant if the due process clause does not apply. So Perry spends a lot of time talking about that because we are still concerned about the admission of unreliable evidence, even if the due process does not require that gatekeeping check that the district court judge has to do if the due process clause is triggered. So if the due process clause applies, because this was state action, because both the principal and the case law can only reasonably conclude that this was state action and the due process clause applies, then all of those other safeguards are irrelevant to the question of whether this identification evidence should have been admissible at the Spriegel hearing. And so that's why Perry spends so long talking about them, is because Perry says the due process clause doesn't apply. We have other ways to make sure that the jury doesn't convict someone based on unreliable identification evidence, and it's all those other things. So those things don't matter if the court agrees that the due process clause is triggered here. I would ask the court, or I guess I'll just ask, that the court closely looks at the language of Perry and Mosley. There is language very clearly in those cases that talks about state action. And I think as for all the arguments that I've already made, the only really sound resolution of that issue is to say that the due process clause applies. I will make one plug to urge the court to actually decide that issue and not just jump to the clear and convincing part of the analysis. This is something that comes up. I myself have had two or three appeals now where the issue is whether Perry and Mosley really only mean law enforcement or whether they also mean other state actors. I think it would be helpful to have some resolution of that issue. And frankly, it would make it very hard for me to get review granted by the Supreme Court if this court doesn't decide that issue. Moving quickly to the sentencing issue. The statute, I want to make very clear, is about past criminal behavior. That's the language of the dangerous offender statute. So the conduct at issue in the Chisago County case, the drive-by shooting that Mr. Garcia was convicted of, is not part of the evidence on which an aggravated sentence can be imposed. What the jury could properly consider for past criminal behavior is high frequency and long involvement. That's the language of the dangerous offender statute. And so what we've got for that, what was submitted to the jury for that, is this limited set of documents that showed two convictions for which Mr. Garcia received probationary sentences, and then the Spriegel incident, which for which he had not yet been convicted. I think the case law is very helpful it doesn't always have to line up, but I have found no other case, precedential or not, where an aggravated sentence under the dangerous offender statute is upheld, imposed, and then upheld based on two offenses and one non-convicted offense within a 7-year period. And so I do, Judge Cochran, sorry.
Oh, I have two follow-up questions for you. First, the language of the statute says in subdivision 2-2-1 or Romanet 1, the offender's past criminal behavior, such as, and then it lists the high frequency rate or long involvement in criminal activity. So does that language limit the consideration to those, to just high frequency rate or long involvement, or is such as, does that provide an example?
Well, such as is an example, but I think the point I was trying to make is that definition, those examples are describing in the statute the requirement that what be considered is past criminal behavior. So for instance, the case law considers not just the past criminal, the actual convictions, for instance, but were they violent? Was the defendant in prison for long chunks of time in between the different offenses? So I agree it can be broader than high frequency or long involvement, although I think those are the key considerations. My point is that it can't be the conduct of a current offense. That can't support the departure.
Thank you. That's helpful. And then Judge Johnson, if you don't mind, I have one further question. I'm wondering if you can address the standard of review that we should apply to the district court's determination or sentencing decision, rather.
I agree at this stage, based on what opposing counsel said, with the standard of review. It's why I thought I needed to file a reply brief that just addressed that question, that this is both a cognizable claim on appeal and that this court treats sufficiency of the evidence of an aggravating factor the same way it treats sufficiency of the evidence of an element of the offense. So there is not really a dispute about the contents of the evidence that was submitted to the Blakely jury. The question for this court is taking that evidence and viewing it in the light most favorable to the state, does that prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Garcia was a dangerous offender within the meaning of the statute, keeping in mind the directive from the Minnesota Supreme Court in Neal that even departures under the dangerous offender statute have to be made with a view that departures are the exception, not the rule, and that they need to be done to promote consistency and rationality and proportioning in sentences. And if this court affirms this sentence, then what that is going to signal is that two convictions and an unconvicted Spriegel incident is enough to be a dangerous offender under this statute. And I think that is vastly beyond the intent of the legislature. For those reasons, I would ask that this court reverse and remand for a new trial or alternatively reverse Mr. Garcia's sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bond, and thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is now submitted.